Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Bidder Information webcast. This webcast is related to the Fall 2024 Index Rack RFP for utility scale wind, utility scale solar, brownfield site photovoltaic projects, as well as hydropower projects. Joining me today and presenting is Ms. Chandrika Mittal from the Illinois Power Agency, as well as Ms. Katie Olandi from NERA. My name is Benjamin Chi. I'm with NERA Economic Consulting. NERA is the procurement administrator on behalf of the Illinois Power Agency for this RFP. So a few housekeeping items. From this cover slide, you'll see some logos at the bottom of the slide. And this procurement is the procurement of RECs for the IPA's portfolio of these utilities that you'll find here. Ameren Illinois Company, or AIC for short, Commonwealth Edison Company, or ComEd, as well as Mid-American Energy Company, or MEC for short. These are the names that you will see recurring in some of the slides going forward, and these entities are also what we call companies collectively throughout the RFP and throughout this presentation. On this slide two, we have a housekeeping item. Please take note that today's presentation, the presentation itself, and the audio recording will be posted to the RFP website, and you will find the URL for the procurement website here, www.ipa-energyrfp.com. You can ask your questions at any point in time during this presentation if anything is unclear, and you can do so by simply locating the chat icon at the bottom of your screen. When it pops up the screen, you will be able to type in your question, reference any slide numbers, and hit submit to send it to the presenters. So this procurement is pursuant to the provisions in the Illinois legislation, as well as the FALT 2024 update to the IPA's long-term renewable resources procurement plan as approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission. And the docket number for this is 23-0714. So the governing documents will include the IPA Act, the Illinois Public Utilities Act, the 2024 long-term plan, as well as the commission's order in the docket and the RFP rules and the final contract that have been posted yesterday, September 25th. You can find the documents on our website. The link is provided here again at the bottom of this slide. And the disclaimer is that you will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding these documents. Any statements that we make on this call that describe or refer to these governing documents, including the RFP and the contract, they're all summaries only, and they're qualified in their entirety by reference to these documents. So here's a snapshot of the procurement website. The URL is found on the top of this slide. Once you're there, you should see the IPA logo at the top. If you scroll to the left navigation bar will list some of the ongoing procurements. And this particular RFP is entitled, as you can see, the Index Wind, Solar, Brownfield, and Hydro RFP. If you click on that, there will be a couple of sublinks that will pop up. One of them will show the final materials link. Click on that and you will see the full set of documents that are posted as of September 25th here. So for today, the agenda, we have a presentation that will cover about 70 slides, and we have scheduled more or less about 90 minutes to go through the material and have some time at the end for questions. So in terms of what we have to cover, we will provide you a background and context for this RFP and then provide you at a very high level an overview of the entire RFP as well as what you can expect in terms of the requirements. We will walk through the terms of the transaction as provided in the supplier contract, and the latter part of the presentation are the more practical aspects of your participation, basically talking about the RFP process, requirements, and deadlines, as well as the bid and post-bid process. So with that, I'd like to turn the time over to Ms. Chandrika Mittal from the Illinois Power Agency.
Thank you. Before we go into the details about this current procurement, I just want to highlight how we got here. So, as most of you know, CEJA, the Climate Equitable Jobs Act, was passed in 2021, and that significantly changed in how we conduct procurements, in that we moved to an index REC structure. So, procurements conducted in 2022 and 2023 were under this new index REC structure. Another key update to our procurements was the inclusion of hydropower projects via Public Act 103-0380. Another key reference point for our procurements is the long-term renewable resources plan that the IPA files every 2 years. Last one was filed in April of 2024, or rather approved in April 2024. It sets up the stage in how we conduct these procurements, and the current plan allows us to follow the framework for procurements conducted in 2024 and 2025. You can access more information on this plan on the agency's website. Can we jump to the next slide, please? Thank you. A key pillar of CEJA was the focus on equity portion, so that's something I want to highlight today. It is very important to the state and to the program. The minimum equity standard was the way we started tracking equity in these projects, and it is now a requirement for projects participating in the program, and the information can be found on the website listed here. Another key aspect of that equity portion is the Energy Workforce Equity Portal. This equity portal also has information around our equity standards, including the ability to find equity eligible persons, which is defined as a person living in an equity investment eligible community. The webpage has equity investment eligible community map, which can be used to find these eligible communities. They are primarily the R3 areas, which were established as part of the Cannabis Regulation Act, and the environmental justice communities. Again, more information can be found on the website here. I will turn it back over to Mr. Chi.
Thank you, Ms. Mittal. So I will now jump right into a high-level overview of the RFP process itself. So the first thing to note is that the bid date is on December 2nd. So with that, we have these targets that are listed here. These numbers represent the number of RECs that we're looking to procure across all projects within the category and that are an annualized number. So these reflect targets to be delivered annually over the 20-year term. We have over 5 million RECs to be delivered annually from utility scale wind and hydro projects. This is one category for purposes of evaluation and accounting for the target. We have over 600,000 RECs annually for utility scale solar projects, and we have 148,000 RECs annually for brownfield site photovoltaic projects. So these targets, to be clear, take into account unfilled quantities from prior rounds. The long-term plan actually provides for the targets, and any unfilled quantities are then rolled over at this point for this particular procurement. The contract will feature an index REC structure where payments will flow either from buyer to seller or seller to buyer. The RECs must be from these winning projects that are proposed in the RFP, and because there are three utility counterparties, there will be an allocation of your RECs, and you'll be signing three contracts for your winning projects. In your bid, you'll be indicating a strike price on a dollar per megawatt hour basis. The strike price is not what you're going to get paid, but the strike price is what will be used to compare against something called an index price, and the difference at each hour will be used to calculate the price for payment of the RECs. There will be a quantity that you will name as part of your bid. And this is what we call the full quantity in the RFP documents, and it's just an annual number of racks that you're committing to as part of your bid. There is also a minimum quantity that we are asking you to provide as your bid or part of your bid. This is used in a case where we have to fill the target, and taking on another project would cause the target to be exceeded. So at that point, we will award a seller that is willing to accept a partial award, something less than the full quantity, but no less than this minimum quantity that you will indicate as part of your bid. And the last component to the bid is really for you to indicate an index hub, either the PJM Northern Illinois hub or the MISO Illinois hub, for purposes of the index price trading hub and calculation of your price. So on slide 11, we'll talk about the size requirements and the location requirements. As we have said earlier, we are looking to solicit bids for four categories. You have the utility scale solar, utility scale wind, the brownfield site PV projects, and the hydropower projects. In terms of size, for utility scale solar and wind projects, the size must be greater than 5 megawatts. This is on an AC rating basis. There are no size restrictions. You can go below that for brownfield site photovoltaic projects and hydropower projects. In terms of location, for brownfield projects, the projects must be located entirely within the brownfield site, and we'll be asking you to demonstrate evidence of the brownfield site in the RFP process. For all the projects, meaning non-brownfield projects, the project site itself will be entered into the contract, and 50% of your project must be located within the site map that you provide through the RFP stage. And these non-brownfield projects could either be in Illinois or in a state that is adjacent to Illinois but must meet the public interest criteria. As Ms. Mittal has mentioned earlier, we have introduced the inclusion of hydropower projects into the procurement. And a hydropower project could either be a new project or a newly modernized or retooled hydropower project. So, new hydropower projects are basically new facilities that includes the impoundment facilities, diversion facilities, pump storage facilities that use the flow of water to generate electricity or storage at an existing dam. If your project is a modernized or retooled hydropower project, it must be a project that involves the construction, repair, maintenance, or significant expansion of the turbines at the existing facility. And it must be located at an existing dam of the existing hydro power facility or dam as provided here. But importantly, for any newly modernized or retooled project, as a result of the modernized or retooled activities, it must meet what we call some threshold for materiality for inclusion in the procurement. So the materiality thresholds are such that it must result from the activities of retooling and modernization, an increase in the installed capacity of the existing facility. That's the first point. The second point is that the actual annual energy production must be increased by at least 30% as a result of the modernized or retooled activities. And we will be asking you to show us evidence of the output before the refurbishment start date and after the refurbishment start completion date. And we'll get to that later on in this presentation. So, a couple of terms to keep us straight. So, regarding energization requirements, your project must be considered new under Illinois law, which means that for utility scale solar, wind, or brownfield projects or new hydro projects, we are after this term called the date of first operation, as understood by GETS or NRETS. And this must be after June 1st, 2017. If your project is a newly modernized or retooled hydropower project, then the hydropower refurbishment completion date must be after June 1st, 2017. We'll use these short names, DFO, to refer to the date of first operation, or DRCD to refer to the hydropower refurbishment completion date in some of the slides going forward. Over on to slide 14 here, in terms of what we are buying and what we are not buying. So to be very clear, first, we're not buying your project. We're not buying your energy. We're not buying your capacity. We're just buying the RECs from your project. The RECs must be RECs from the project selected through the RFP. And what this means is that replacement RECs are not eligible to be transferred under the supplier contract. The RECs must include all environmental attributes and must be transferred via a standing order through GATS or MRATS. They must be retired, must be transferred in an unretired state that allows buyer, the counterparty, to retire them and comply with the Illinois RPS. There's going to be a contract for 20 years of delivery, and we will accept RECs starting from as early as the vintage month of January 2025 if they are available. The deadline for the first REC to be delivered as a standard deadline is currently set at May 31st, 2029. This is basically, again, a standard deadline for when we expect the first REC to be delivered. If you need more time to get your project energized and get that project operational and online, the contract does have a very generous extension policy that allows a 2-year initial extension with no questions asked, and further extensions for good cause that must be requested. In terms of the RFP, this is a two-part application process. Part one, we have the window that runs from September 30th to October 18. This is a noon central prevailing time deadline. And then we have a part two that runs from November 1st that ends on the part two date. Again, a noon prevailing time, central prevailing time deadline on November 15. The main thing to understand here is that the entire process is done online. Part one will be for you to respond to qualification requirements. You provide us your contact information, some information about the bidder, the seller, the project. And the only thing that is outside of the online form is the payment of the bid participation fee. And this is paid to the Illinois Power Agency and paid only one time for calendar year 2024. If you have done so earlier this year, you don't need to do that again. Part two is for you to provide additional information and certifications, as well as provide your bid assurance collateral. So again, the only thing outside of the form is the bid assurance collateral that goes directly to each of the utilities. We have a slide here on evaluation. Once you have successfully participated in the part one and part two proposal process, then it's for us to receive your bids. The bid window is here and will take place on December 2nd. That's the bid date. Bids will be evaluated on a price-only basis. We are not engaging in any post-bid negotiation under this process. There'll be no post-bid negotiations. Bids will be evaluated for each category separately for purposes of evaluation. Wind and hydropower projects are evaluated as one category. We have a benchmark that is developed in consultation with the procurement monitor, approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission, and only bids that do not exceed the benchmark are being considered. We have also in place some bid price adjustments for projects that are proposing an equity level above the minimum equity standard of 10%, as well as projects that are sited in one of the ETCG areas or hydropower preference communities, and we'll get to that later on in this presentation. The last bullet here on this slide 16 talks about the fact that we have RFP provisions to implement the REC targets as soft caps. What it means is that for each category, the rules now allow us to procure The marginal project, even if it causes us to exceed the target under certain conditions, and we will talk about this later on in the presentation. So I have a word here on the fees that are associated with the procurement. I will talk here first about the bid participation fee. The fee is set currently at $500 per bidder. If you have multiple projects, you pay this once for all your projects. And importantly, you pay this once for all procurement events in 2024. If you have done this already, you do not need to do so again. This is paid to the IPA by the Part 1 date of October 18. The second type of fee is what we call the supplier fees. Supplier fees are not paid by all bidders, but they are paid by winning bidders or bidders with winning projects. The amount or the requirement is to be confirmed to you no later than November 26, which is 2 business days prior to the bid date. At this time, we're just giving you an estimate of the supplier fees, and the supplier fees are currently set at 60 cents of the annual quantity of RECs that will be awarded to you. So just take note, this is just an estimate, and we will adjust this estimate if necessary closer to the bid date, but no later than November 26. In terms of the supplier contracts, I'll do a quick dive here into the key elements of the contract. The final contract has been posted to the RFP website on September 25th. You will find not just a posted contract, but a couple of red lines that help you look to see what has changed relative to prior contracts, prior procurements. The contract main body itself will contain the rights and obligations between the parties, buyer and seller, and the project and transaction specific information will be entered into the product order, the form of which is provided in Exhibit A. So I'll highlight a few things here. So on this slide, you'll see certain sections highlighted or bolded for your convenience. These are things that you may want to look deeper for your own sake. First, the product and facility requirements are spelled out in Article 2. Delivery obligations are provided in Article 4. Payment and invoicing requirements can be found in Article 5. There are a bunch of reporting requirements that are encapsulated in Article 6. And collateral and credit requirements can be found in Article 7. We also have a bunch of examples that can be found in the appendices or exhibits appended to the end of the contract. Throughout this presentation and the next couple of slides, I'm going to highlight a few things for those that have been participating or following us for the last couple of rounds. So updates stemming from the comment process this round are provided in the next couple of slides and indicated with this wording in red new so that you know what has changed as you review the contract terms. So I'll touch on just the basics here on the contract. So the contract is between you, the seller, who has the right to convey title and transfer the RECs to buyer. The buyer in this case of each of the companies, Ameren Illinois Commet and Mid-American Company. There's going to be three agreements to be signed with each company. So you must be willing to sign three agreements for each winning project. The RECs for each winning project are then allocated among these companies by us, the procurement administrator. Once the contract is signed, then the contracts will be administered separately by each of the companies. Slide 21 here basically translate for you the bid information into contract information. Again, in your bids, you will name a quantity. You name a strike price and you'll name the index hub. So, the quantity that is awarded, as I said, in this case, as an example, 100,000 RECs to be delivered annually will be allocated by us to each of the three utilities, not evenly, but in some fashion that you will be alerted to. So the allocated quantity in each contract will then be known as the annual quantity in the specific contract. The strike price, as well as the index hub, will be then also indicated in the product order in each of these contracts. The maximum quantity that can be paid out or settled under the contract is the maximum contract quantity and is simply your annual quantity under the contract times 20, which is reflective of the 20-year delivery term. So if you bid 100,000 racks, you can kind of expect, to take this 100,000 racks times 20 to get to the aggregate number across all three contracts. Over onto this slide 22, this is a very key slide to talk about the index rack mechanism. The index rack mechanism is designed to mimic a bundle transaction for energy and racks. So while we tell you that we are paying and receiving your racks only, but not buying your energy or capacity, that is kind of true, but at the same time, not complete. So to be very clear, index rack mechanism, I'll say again, is designed to mimic a bundle transaction for energy and racks. So to illustrate this concept, the index rack mechanism is designed so that you do not need to look for a separate off-taker for your energy. But as you supply your energy to the grid, you will be paid for your energy by the RTO, PJM or MISO. And we will pay you the difference between your strike price and the real-time LMP at the index hub. You will choose the index hub, either the PJM NiHub or the MISO Illinois hub. So conceptually, I'm saying that this is not exactly, but generally true, because we are generally trying to get you close to your strike price, making you whole at the strike price that you indicate that you need to develop the project and to operate and maintain it for a 20-year term. So between the energy payments you get from the RTO and the payments under the index rack contract, we should get you very close to the strike price. That is the hope. And the place where I think we want to make sure that you understand is that this is not exactly going to get you to the strike price for at least two things. One, the hourly LMP that we're using as a proxy to the energy payments we think you're getting is at the index hub. You're not getting the LMP at the index hub. You're getting whatever LMP you're getting from the project's PNO. And so all that is saying is that you're taking on any basis risk between the project's PNO and the index hub. The second item to flag for you is that we are not asking the question, are you getting any capacity payments or other forms of payments for ancillary services or any other payments you're getting from the RTO, PJM, or MISO? If you get them, they're yours to keep. All we are using is the LMP at the index hub to figure out how much to pay you. So the formulas here on this page are basically trying to figure out on an hourly basis the calculation for the settlement price at each hour that is weighted by the generation of your project for that hour. And we're basically aggregating it so that we can find a price that is based on the hourly components of the monthly price, so that invoicing and payment could occur on a monthly basis. The invoice amount that occurs monthly is basically calculated based on the hourly LMPs aggregated across the month, weighted by your generation for that month, times the racks that are delivered for that vintage month. And then maybe I'll touch on one item here that may not be obvious, is that when we say that there are two options for the index hub, either the PJM NiHub or MISO Illinois hub, you get to choose that in your bid, is going to be an election. Once it is in a bid form, you cannot change that going forward. importantly, want to note for you that you could be interconnected in PJM, but choose the MISO Illinois hub, or you could be having a project that is interconnected in MISO and choose the PJM NI-Hub. Or you could also be not interconnected with PJM or MISO at all, but you're required to make that election so that we know how to calculate the price for purposes of the contract. So over on this slide 23, we'll provide an illustrative example of how invoicing and payment will work. And here we're just recognizing that there is going to be a time lag between electricity generated that is in the vintage month and when RECs are being issued by GETS and MRETS, and only after which you'll be able to invoice and get paid for those RECs that have been generated, issued, and transferred to the buyer's account. So the month in which electricity is generated is known as the vintage month. In this example, it is July 2025. By the fifth business day after the vintage month has concluded, this puts us in August 7, 2025. This is the business day basis, accounting for any holidays that may have passed, as well as weekends. You'll be required at that time to provide the hourly generation data to the IPA and buyer for the vintage month. The IPA will then use that information to calculate the price of the RECs for the vintage month of July and will issue to buyer and seller by the 20th day of the month. And the IPA will issue what we call a price calculation notice. RECs are expected to be delivered via the standing order only at the end of the following month, following the vintage month, which puts us at the end of August. By September 10th, this is when not just the calculation of the prices are known, the RECs have been delivered. This is when you will start to invoice the buyer for the RECs themselves based on the price and the quantity that has been delivered. And if your invoice is received by the buyer by September 10, you can expect payment to occur by September 30th of the month, or the month following the month when the price calculation and the RECs have been transferred. Here we have an illustrative example of the invoice calculation. The invoicing details are found in section 5.1 of the index REC contract. You're required to invoice buyer each month, regardless of whether payments flow from buyer to seller or payment is due to buyer from seller. So for payment, there'll be two components: a price component, which is the price calculation notice that you'll find from the IPA. The price component will be found there, and then a volume component, which is just based on the number of RECs that you have delivered during the month for that vintage. So in this case, a negative price means payment flows from buyer to seller. In this example, the price calculated by the IPA is $2.98 times the quantity of RECs delivered, 80, get you to the payment of $238.40 that is being invoiced and will be settled based on the instructions of the invoice. I will have a word here about the REC tracking system and, in particular, the standing order. So, you'll be required to register your projects with either GETS or MRETS and to establish a standing order. The standing order will be based on a few things, but will reflect a portion of the RECs committed to each of Ameren Illinois, ComEd, and MidAmerican. The standing order is set based on the allocated share of the RFP awarded annual quantity and something we call the project committed percentage. The project committed percentage allows you to find another commercial off-taker if you would like for a portion of your projects to be committed elsewhere other than the three utilities under this procurement. So, a word here on timing first. This project commit percentage is not required of you during the RFP stage. Once your project is energized and you are about to set up your standing order, that is when you indicate to buyer what the RFP committed percentage is. Two things to note: you're still committed to your annual quantity in your bid, and there is no prohibition on the size changes under the contract. If you propose a 50 megawatt project and you would like to build something larger, you can do so. And for this solicitation, we have included provisions. This is a new item here. We have included provisions to accommodate changes to the project committed percentage and standing order if there is a change in the nameplate capacity during the delivery term. To be very clear, the project committed percentage and the standing order generally cannot be changed and is allowed to change only in this limited circumstance when there is a change in nameplate capacity during the delivery term. Two reminders: the earliest possible vintage for awards under this contract will be January 2025. If your project has recently been energized or will be energized prior to January 2025, you need not, or rather, I should say, you will need to establish your standing order within 30 days of the start of the year, January 1, 2025. But you do not need to do so any earlier than that. If your project has been energized, or rather, the opposite, I should say, if your project has not been energized at this time or will not be energized anytime soon, then you'll need to initiate the standing order within 30 days of the date of first operation. Or if your project is a newly modernized and retooled hydropower project, then you need to do so within 30 days of the hydropower refurbishment completion date. For the details, just take a look at section 2 of the contract. We'll have a word here on the credit and collateral requirements. So for the collateral requirements under the contract, for wind and hydro facilities, we're looking at $4 times the annual quantity. For solar projects, this will be $10 times the annual quantity that you are being awarded. So again, this is not for the full quantity across 20 years. This is for the annual quantity that you indicate in your bid forms that will be then translated into the contract and allocated each contract. $4 for wind and hydro, and $10 for utility scale solar and brownfield. So these requirements are subject to a minimum of $20,000. The collateral requirements are specific to the contract with a utility counterparty. So when we talk about the annual quantity here, we're really after the annual quantity allocated to the utility itself that will be required of you under the contract. If your project is delayed for whatever reason and there is a need for you to post additional collateral to extend the deadline, the automatic extension will require the doubling of the collateral requirement. Basically, at that point, if you're looking for an extension, the first extension out 2 years, this will be a total of $8 for wind and hydro projects, and a total of $20 for utility scale wind and brownfield projects. So you just increase it 2 times to get to the increased amount that must be posted. We have an unsecured credit that will be provided for the seller, or if you're relying on a guarantor, you will need to provide a acceptable parental guarantee to get the unsecured credit. And these are only for investment grade ratings, meaning that you must meet at least a minimum of triple B minus or above for S&P and Fitch, and Baa3 or above for Moody's. The collateral threshold on unsecured credit is set at $2.5 million, and any exposure above this $2.5 million must be covered with either cash or a letter of credit. If you have posted cash as pre-bid collateral, you have the option to request for that cash to become post-bid collateral without moving the money back and forth. In terms of the delivery obligations, the initial delivery again must occur by May 31st, 2029. You can extend that by posting additional collateral, as I have noted. And any subsequent extensions beyond the initial extension to 2031 will be on a case-by-case basis at the request and approval of the IPA upon your demonstration for good cause that are outside of your control. And you can find more information about these extensions in Section 2.4 of the REC contract. On this slide, we have an illustration of the time elements of the contract. So under the REC contract, payments and pricing are tied to the vintage of your RECs. We'll cover two items here, the delivery term and the acceptable vintage period. So the vintage period is basically tied to when electric generation occurs that will give rise to the RECs that you're delivering. The earliest vintage month cannot be earlier than January 2025. This is the earliest vintage we would accept. It could be later if your project is not online yet, but cannot be earlier than Jan 2025. In general, whenever the project becomes operational, that is when we will call the earliest vintage month. The latest vintage month is just 241 months after the earliest vintage month. This gives you a full 20 years plus one extra month to account for any stop period if your project is not energized at the start of the month and there is a sort of a stop month at the beginning when your project has reached commercial operation. The delivery term will be more or less tracking with the acceptable vintage period. The delivery term starts on the first day the RECs are issued for your project, either by GETS or MRETS. This starts the clock of the delivery term for all the utilities concurrently and will end on the last day of the third month after the latest vintage month. So in this case, if the latest vintage month is January 2045, then the end of the delivery term will be April 30th, 2045. This will allow you additional months to turn in your RECs through the standing order. So, what are your delivery obligations under the contract? Your delivery obligations will be accounted for on an annual basis. And it's what we call the delivery year requirement. This DYR or delivery year requirement is what you have to hit each year. And this is generally just the annual quantity that is allocated to the project, adjusted for any degradation rate. There's no degradation applied for wind and hydro projects, but if you're a solar project, you get to name your own degradation rate to get to the delivery year requirement. There is a spreadsheet online you can use to help you translate annual quantity to delivery year requirement. There is an example at the end of the REC contract that talks about that. So I ask you to familiarize yourself with how the delivery year requirement is being calculated. And adjust it to the degradation rate that you're providing. The delivery requirement for the 20 years basically sets out the delivery schedule for each year, is provided or going to be provided in your product order when you execute the contract. So this is known right after the award. Once the contract is executed, look for the product order. The delivery requirement for each of the 20 years is all listed there. It tells you what your obligations are for each of those 20 years. So the basic concept here is that you have to hit the delivery requirement each year. And if you fail to meet the delivery requirement for 5 times, and the sum of the shortfall is at 2 times the annual quantity. So we've increased it from the annual quantity now to 2 times the annual quantity. Then your contract will be terminated and your collateral requirement will be forfeited. So take note, we've increased the flexibility under the contract. So now You cannot fall short of this 2 times the annual quantity requirement. On top of that, I will note a few things. The first 2 full deliveries will not be counted against you, and there will be no shortfall amounts that is being recorded during the stub period through the end of the first 2 full delivery years. A delivery again runs from June through May of the following year. And at this time, if you still miss your delivery obligations and it exceeds more than 2 times of the annual quantity, and your contract is subject to termination and forfeiture of collateral, we have instituted a waiver process for the IPA to waive a portion or all of the shortfalls on a case-by-case basis upon a demonstration of good cause by seller. And this is at the IPA's sole discretion, but we have provided a waiver process that you may request. And we ask that you go take a look at Section 9.2K of the REC contract for this waiver process. So, on top of the waiver process, on top of the flexibility that has been enhanced with 2 years of the annual quantity, here we have a word on ineligible RECs and excess RECs, making clear at least 2 things for you. The first is that if RECs are not eligible for payment, they are your property to be used by you however you want. So I'll go through a few examples here. RECs may not be transferred due to the project committed percentage. You may have set it up such that in your standing order, some of the RECs does not get transferred to the utilities account. Those cannot be paid under the regular invoicing and payment schedule. We will return that back to you. There could be ineligible RECs outside of the acceptable vintage period. Those will be returned back to you. Any excess RECs in excess of the delivery requirement, based on the REC vintage of the delivery year, will also be returned back to you, as well as any inadvertent transfers. I'm not sure how that will happen, but if it does happen, we have a process laid out in Section 2.3 of the contract that talks about the return back of these RECs. And the other point for you to note is that to help you mitigate any risk of an event of default due to under deliveries, you may make manual transfer in any year that you're long against prior shortfall years. You'll find this in Section 2.3F of the contract. But basically, here is another accommodation for you to make a manual transfer, including some of these RECs that may not be eligible for payment, to cover any shortfall. Basically, these would be RECs that are outside or in excess of the delivery year requirement and outside of the project committed percentage. There are also labor-related requirements under the contract. I will talk about the prevailing wage requirement first. So this is applicable to all projects throughout the contract term. As long as there is construction activities that occur, you need to ensure that you're paying general prevailing wage or of hourly wages. These are the terms you'll find under the contract. You must provide documentation and verification in the IPA. The first report will be due 5 business days, either from the date of first operation of your project, or if your project is already energized at this time, then 5 business days of the effective date of the agreement. And throughout the term of the contract, if applicable work is being done, we ask that you provide the IPA documentation and verification that demonstrates your compliance with the Prevailing Wage Act, and to do so no later than August 1st following the year where construction activities have occurred. If your project is outside of Illinois, is in an adjacent state, and if there is a prevailing wage that is published for use, then use that or use the federal Davis-Bacon rate if it is not available to comply with the Illinois Prevailing Wage Act requirements. All we are looking here for is wage parity, and you can look more closely at the definitions for construction activities to know what is covered, as well as Section 6.2 of the Reg Contract to know your obligations there. The next item I want to talk about is the project labor agreement requirements. This applies to projects that are, first of all, not hydropower projects. There's no such PLA requirements tied to hydropower projects. For the rest of the projects that are not hydropower, this is applicable if the project began construction activities on or after September 15, 2021. So if you begin construction activities after this date, you'll be required to comply with the PLA and need to file your project labor agreement with the IPA 30 days of the execution of the PLA or the effective date of the PLA or the agreement if it has been already executed and the contract or the project has already been operational, or 60 days prior to the start of the construction. So this is what is stated in the law. If you have a pre-hire agreement, a PLA in place before you start construction, please file the PLA with the IPA so that you can comply with Section 6.3 of the Reg Contract. Over here on slide 32, we'll talk about the minimum equity standard, what we call the MES. MES is for a minimum of 10%. So 10% of your project labor workforce must be from what we call equity eligible persons. The 10% as the minimum will not change throughout the term of the agreement. This is applicable for construction of projects that have not been completed as of December 15, 2021, and applies through the date of first operation, or if it is a modernized and retooled project, then we're looking at the application of the MES through the hydropower refurbishment completion date. You have three reports to provide for this: a compliance plan that is forward-looking due by June 1st each year, a mid-year confirmation due by December 1st each year, and after the conclusion of a compliance year, the MES report is due by July 15, following the delivery year or the compliance year to demonstrate that you have complied with the MES requirements. For purposes of meeting the MES, if a seller is an EEC, an equity eligible contractor, then 10% of the MES is deemed to have been met and you are no longer subject to the MES reporting requirements. If you're working with a EEC as a subcontractor, then each EEP of the subcontractor will be counted as 1.5 times towards meeting the MES. And you can find more of this information in Section 2.5, as well as Section 6.4 of the Reg Contract. And for us, to verify the generation data each month to calculate your rack price, the monthly rack price, you're required to submit to the IPA the monthly generation report 5 days after the vintage month, 5 business days after the vintage month. That will include the hourly real-time LMP for the index hub, either PJM NY Hub or MISO Illinois Hub, as well as the hourly megawatt hour generation data at the project's P&O. And we will also need access, and in particular, read-only access to either the PJM Power Market System or the MISO Market Portal as applicable. If your project is a newly modernized and retooled project, you will have these materiality threshold requirements to meet. To verify that, we will need you to provide us with the hydropower refurbishment start date, as well as the hydropower refurbishment completion date. And we will need for you to provide hourly megawatt generation data for 4 full delivery years prior to the Hyrule Power refurbishment start date so that we know that you have complied with the refurbishment threshold. You can find more of this information in section 6.1 and 6.5 of the REC contract. And with that, I will turn the time now to Ms. Katie Olandi, who will walk us through the remainder of this presentation on the practical aspect of your participation in the RFP. Ms. Olandi?
Thanks a lot, Ben. So I'm going to start off this next half of the presentation with the schedule for the RFP process, and then I'll go into the process to register for an account so that you can submit a proposal to qualify a project or projects. Then I'll walk through the details of the qualification requirements and process and finish up with a final section on bid submission and evaluation. So the RFP process is going to kick off on Monday. And that's because of the opening of the Part 1 window. So that's on September 30th. And then the process is going to proceed over the next 2 months or so. The qualification process is in two parts. And the first part is the Part 1 proposal when applicants submit their qualification materials. So the Part 1 proposal materials are due on the Part 1 date, which is Friday, October 18th. The bid participation fee of $500 is submitted as part of the Part 1 proposal and therefore is also due by that date. Applicants are given time to cure any deficiencies and to respond to requests for additional information or clarifications from the procurement administrator. And then by October 31st, the Part 1 notification date, applicants are informed whether they have qualified to submit a Part 2 proposal. The Part 2 proposal, that includes posting bid assurance collateral with each of ComEd, Ameren, and MidAmerican in the form of cash or a letter of credit. The Part 2 window opens on Friday, November 1st, and then closes on the Part 2 date on Friday, November 15th. Applicants that have a successful Part 2 proposal are therefore qualified to submit bids on the bid date, which is Monday, December 2nd. And so that's right when we come back from Thanksgiving break on Monday, December 2nd. So the plan is to get everyone qualified and all of the steps completed before we leave for Thanksgiving break. And then you'll come back and on that Monday, the last step will be just to submit the bids. We're going to hold a training session on November 20th. And that's when qualified bidders can ask questions regarding completing and submitting the bid form, and you can practice all aspects of submitting that form that you, as you will do on December 2nd. So then bids that are selected on the bid date will be subject to ICC approval, and the ICC is expected to release its decision on the results of the RFP on Thursday, December 5th. So in order to submit a bid for a project in the RFP, you're going to need to submit a proposal via online proposal forms. To register for an account to access the online proposal forms, you're going to visit the procurement website, ipa-energyrfp.com, fill out the qualification registration form there under Contact Us. You'll need to provide the number of projects for which you intend to submit a proposal, and that's because you're going to submit a separate proposal for each project. If you have multiple projects, you're going to access through one account, but then you're going to fill out one form for each project. You're also going to be asked to provide your name, company name, email address, and phone number. So I would encourage everyone now on this call that plans to participate to go ahead and request your account as soon as practicable. We will issue one account per company, and the information to activate the account is going to be sent to that individual that registers for the account. This individual is going to receive an email with account activation instructions from info@ipa-energyrfp.com, and we have screenshots here to show you what you can expect. We'll also provide that individual with a guide with screenshots for account activation and for completing and submitting the online form and for paying the bid participation fee. So if you register, you can expect to receive account information within 24 hours of doing so, and we're going to start issuing accounts on Monday, the day of the opening of the Part 1 window. Once you have an account, you can access the online forms to work on your proposal or proposals in two ways. You can go directly to the web address that's provided here, forms.ipa-energyrfp.com, or you can access this site through the procurement website. You click on the qualification form subpage under the indexed wind, solar, brownfield, and hydro section of the website, and then click qualification form. So in this next section, I'm going to do a dive into the details of the qualification requirements. Up front here, this slide provides some general information. So for purposes of your proposal, the bidder is the entity that submits the proposal, and the seller is the entity that's going to sign the contract if the project's selected. If there are multiple projects and the sellers for these entities are different, that's totally fine. And I'll talk about this a little more on the next slide. The Part 1 proposal, it consists of information submitted through the online form, and then you'll be uploading supporting documents and inserts. You can upload or you can also email this information. And inserts, they're documents that we're going to provide to you in Word format. You'll fill them in, and in some cases, you'll have to have an authorized individual sign. Right now, these inserts are posted to the procurement website, and they're grouped by category of project. So before you get started, make sure you do download the correct zip file, and then you'll have all the inserts you need to complete the proposal. So as I mentioned on the previous slide, the seller is the signatory to the Index Rec contract, and the bidder is the entity that's submitting the proposal. And we just have some examples here. If you're presenting a single project, it is the case that the bidder and the seller must be named the same entity. But if you're presenting multiple projects, there are a couple of examples for what you can do. So you could use the parent entity as the bidder, that's the situation shown in the bottom box 3, or you can identify the bidder as a list of the seller names separated by a comma. So in section 1, you'll start filling in the form and you're going to be asked to name the project and to provide contact information for the entities and the authorized individuals so that we know who we should be in contact with. For the seller and the bidder, you're going to be required to provide the exact legal name of the entity and the address. You're going to name and provide contact information for an officer of the seller. This is the individual who will make all representations required in the Part 1 and Part 2 for the seller. This individual must be empowered to undertake contracts and bind the seller. You'll also provide contact information for up to 4 representatives. Representatives are individuals that are authorized to act on behalf of the bidder and the seller. These individuals are our main points of contact and will receive all correspondence from us. Lastly, in section 1, you're going to notify us if the seller is an equity eligible contractor. That's a business that's majority owned by equity eligible persons, or a nonprofit or cooperative that is majority owned by equity eligible persons, or is a natural person that is an equity eligible person offering personal services as an independent contractor. And so if the seller is an equity eligible contractor, you will notify that of us in the form and provide documented evidence. So in the Part 1 proposal, you're going to provide basic information for your project. That includes, again, the name and the category. And then you'll give us the project size and megawatt AC rating. Utility scale wind and solar projects must be greater than 5 megawatts. There are no minimum size requirements for brownfield or hydropower projects. For a modernized or retooled hydropower project, you will input the size of the hydropower facility upon completion of the modernized or retooled activities. You're also going to give us the date of first operation, actual or expected, or the hydropower refurbishment completion date, actual or expected. In the Part 1 proposal, unless a project was operational prior to December 15, 2022, or if the seller is an equity eligible contractor, then the officer of the seller will be required to acknowledge that the minimum equity standard of 10% will apply to the project and that there are reporting requirements under the contract. Also in Section 3, building on this, if construction activities for the project have not begun as a submission of the Part 1, then the seller can commit to an equity level that's greater than the MES of 10%. If you do commit, then you could qualify for a bid evaluation price reduction or a preference in ranking as described in the rules. In order to qualify, you will need to provide supporting documentation that's listed in the rules and here on this slide. And that includes a detailed narrative plan of how to meet the higher commitment level. The required information regarding the project site differs across the categories. This slide here is going to cover just wind and solar, utility scale solar. So applicants provide the complete address for the project along with a map. The map must clearly show the location of the project. A project that is located in a state adjacent to Illinois and wishes to qualify on the basis of the public interest criteria in the Act must be pre-approved by the IPA to be eligible for Illinois RPS compliance. So if you have an adjacent state project, you'll go to the IPA's website. We have a link here. There's an evaluation spreadsheet that you'll complete and submit to the IPA for approval. If you have a project located in an adjacent state, do go ahead and download this now and send it to the IPA so that they have time to review and get back to you. You will upload the notice from the IPA that states that you are qualified under the public interest criteria to the form. So that we know that you have been pre-approved. You'll also confirm whether 50% of the project site is located within an energy transition community grant area. If that is the case, you'll provide supporting documentation and the project will qualify for a price reduction for purposes of ranking and selecting bids. Again, you'll provide a map that clearly shows the location of the project and this map will become an exhibit to the contract. Now, moving to Section 5 and the next three slides here, they're going to pertain to qualifying brownfield. So a brownfield site photovoltaic project must be located in Illinois. Adjacent state projects will not qualify. Applicants must provide the complete address along with a map. And importantly, the project must be entirely contained within the brownfield site. Projects that are co-located with another facility on a greenfield site can participate, but you must disclose this fact, and you'll be asked to confirm that the project contained in the brownfield site has its own single dedicated meter and will have its own account registered with PJM Gas or MRED. And the project site to qualify must fit into one of the two buckets from the definition of brownfield under the Act. The project site is either regulated by the US EPA or Illinois EPA under one of four programs in the Act, and I'm going to list those on the next slide. Or the project site is located at the site of a coal mine that has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any remining operations, and is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues. The definition continues here on this slide. So this slide provides the four programs under which a brownfield site qualifying under the first bucket must be regulated. The table provides the program on the left and then a list of sufficient documentation that can be provided as evidence that the project is regulated by that program on the right. We will consider other forms of documentation that you provide to demonstrate regulation. Notably, any document that's submitted must be dated no earlier than 25 years prior to the bid date. Also, there are additional requirements for projects that are regulated by the IEPA site remediation program. And the additional requirements pertain to demonstrating actual blight or contamination at the project site, and they're described in the RFP rules. For a project located at the site of a permanently closed coal mine, the bidder must certify as part of the Part 1 proposal that the coal mine has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any remining operations, and is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues. To demonstrate the project site meets the definition from the Act, a bidder must submit the required permit documentation with the Department of Natural Resources that's listed here on this slide. So we're moving here with this slide to hydropower. This pertains only to hydropower. So applicants will provide the complete address for the project, the name of the existing dam at which the project will be sited, and a map of the project site that clearly shows the location of the project and the dam. A project that's located in a state adjacent to Illinois that wishes to qualify on the basis of the public interest criteria must be pre-approved by the IPA, similar to wind and solar. You'll follow the link here on this slide and complete the spreadsheet and send it to the IPA for evaluation. Applicants in our proposal form will also confirm whether the project site is located within a hydropower preference community. This is either a designated environmental justice community, or it's a community that has medium incomes that do not exceed 82% of the median income in the state of Illinois. And we provide a list of the current hydropower preference communities in Appendix 16 to the RFP rules. Lastly, again, a note here that the map that you provide will become an exhibit to the contract. So there are additional requirements for hydropower projects. The bidder must describe the existing facilities at the project site, provide a detailed description of the project, and describe the milestones that have been reached in project development. For a modernized or retooled hydropower project, you must describe the modernized or retooled activities that will take place at the existing facility. For a new hydropower project, required supporting documentation includes an application with FERC for a preliminary permit or filed documentation for a license or exemption from licensing, and the required documents provided here in this first middle table. For a modernized or retooled project, the bidder must provide a filed application with FERC for a relicense, an application to amend the current license, or an application for an exemption from licensing. And importantly, this documentation must provide evidence that there will be an increase in the installed capacity of the existing facility due to the modernized or retooled activities. It must also reasonably demonstrate, along with your narrative description of the planned activities, that the project can meet the 30% hydropower refurbishment threshold under the contract. In regard to wind, solar, and brownfield, there is a project maturity requirement under the proposal. This can be accomplished by providing the documentation listed in the table from PJM, MISO, or a utility, or it can be done by demonstrating site control for a portion of your project site. So if you can provide a document from the table on this slide, you do not need to provide evidence of site control. And on the flip side, if you've not started the interconnection process, you can still qualify if you show documented evidence of site control for a portion of the site. So if the project's interconnecting with PJM, the applicant can provide the Q OASIS ID and a copy of the completed system impact study. If interconnecting with MISO, if the project is in DPP 2020 cycle one or a later study cycle, you'll provide the project number and a copy of the preliminary system impact study under DPP1. If interconnecting with MISO in an earlier study, then you'll be asked to provide the project number and a copy of the fully executed interconnection agreement. If interconnecting with the utility, please provide the fully executed interconnection agreement if available. If these documents are not available, or if a document that shows the project is farther in the interconnection process is not available, then the bidder must describe the stage of development. And then, as I mentioned, you'll provide evidence of site control. So to figure out how much site control is required, you can use this slide. You'll need to demonstrate site control for at least 40 acres times the project size for a utility scale wind project, at least 4 acres times the project size for a utility scale solar project, and at least 3 times the project size for a brownfield site photovoltaic project. This table on the slide also provides a list of accepted documentation to demonstrate site control, and there are many documents that would be accepted. Also, you can provide different documents for different landowners. If the document that you provide is a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding, then please note it must satisfy specific minimum requirements. We have a document posted right now, Appendix 4 to the RFP rules, that outlines these minimum requirements. There are requirements for some projects related to the project labor agreements. Ben discussed this under the contract section. If construction activities for the project began prior to September 15, 2021, then this requirement does not apply to the project. The requirement also does not apply to hydro. If construction activities have begun as of the submission of the Part 1 proposal, but did not begin prior to September 15, 2021, then the bidder should file their project labor agreements with the director of the IPA by email, and then you'll submit evidence of having done so with your proposal. If construction activities have not begun as of the submission of the Part 1, then the seller will be required to certify that the project will be built by general contractors that have entered into a project labor agreement prior to construction. The seller will be required to make a number of certifications regarding the project and the seller entity. Examples are that the project will have a single revenue quality meter, and there will be no substitution for another project. In regard to the seller, an officer will be required to accept the terms of the contract and will acknowledge the collateral requirement, for example. The seller notably must also certify that seller, including contractors and subcontractors rendering services under the IREC contract, will comply with the requirements of the Prevailing Wage Act. This slide here continues with requirements of sections 8 and 9 in the Part 1 proposal. So if the seller or its guarantor is rated by one or more of the major rating agencies, that's S&P, Moody's, or Fitch, then all available credit ratings must be provided. This information will be used for a credit assessment under the contract. It's not a requirement for seller to be rated or to have a rated guarantor in order to participate. It's just if you need a credit evaluation prior to the bid date, then this is the time that you do it. In section 9, the bidder will provide evidence of payment of the bid participation fee. Again, this is a $500 non-refundable fee that all bidders will pay if they have not paid due to participation in a prior procurement event in 2024. If you plan to use a letter of credit to post financial guarantees under the contract, should you be a winner in the RFP, then it's a great idea to begin working with your financial institution to get these documents in place. You should start now. You can download the 2 options for the posted letter of credit that are provided as exhibits to the contract, and you may submit red lines with changes requested by your bank for review by the companies. You'll submit these red lines by email to us or by upload to the Part 1 form. They will be processed and reviewed by the companies, and then you'll receive a response on whether the modifications are acceptable or not. There are preliminary lists of modifications that are acceptable to each company already posted on the procurement website. You can also provide comments on or propose modifications to the standard pre-bid letter of credit to meet the bid assurance collateral requirement with the Part 2. So there are two versions of the standard pre-bid letter of credit for a company, and they have two different terms. So there's an electronic version that accommodates transmission by the issuing bank by electronic means. And then there's a hard copy version that accommodates transmission by the bank via overnight delivery service. So depending on your bank, you'll use one of these two versions, and they're posted in zip files on the website now. And again, there are preliminary lists of modifications that are acceptable to each company already posted on the website. They're also grouped by electronic versus hard copy version. So if your bank requires an edit that's on this preliminary list, then it's okay to use it. Otherwise, submit your red lines to us during Part 1 for an evaluation. If it's acceptable, then we will add the modification to a final list that's posted and available to all bidders to use. Once you've completed your form for a project and you're ready to submit it to us for review, you'll click submit on the online form, and then your proposal will be evaluated promptly by us. While we evaluate your proposal, you will be temporarily locked out of the account for that project. We'll provide a notice back to you as soon as the evaluation is complete, and that will be either a complete notice or a deficiency notice. If you receive a deficiency notice, then it will include a detailed list of items to clarify or complete, and will provide you with a further deadline. Generally, bidders are given until the Part 1 date or 2 business days, whichever is later, to respond to a first request for additional information. You know, you don't need to wait until the deadline on October 18th. If you're done, you filled out the form for a project, go ahead and submit it to us as soon as you're ready. But the Part 1 date, the final deadline for when you must submit is October 18th. The Part 1 notification will when you'll be informed whether you may submit a Part 2 proposal is October 31st. So the components of the Part 1 notification are listed here on this slide. So should your project qualify pursuant to a Part 1, you're going to get a letter notifying you of your qualified status, a customized bid form that will be used to submit bids for all of your qualified projects. You'll get instructions for completing and submitting the bid form on the bid date, an invitation to a training session to practice bid submission procedures, confidential credentials in order to log into the Secure Bid Transfer site and submit your bid form, and then you'll get detailed instructions, including wiring information, et cetera, for providing bid assurance collateral to the companies. If your project's qualified, you'll submit your Part 2 materials beginning the following day. By the Part 2 date on November 15th, you must provide the first 3 bullets here. So you're going to submit information through, again, another online Part 2 form, upload some more inserts with certifications, and then, of course, submit the bid assurance collateral in the form of cash or a letter of credit to each of the companies. Your bid, which is the fourth part of the proposal, is not due by November 15th. It's due by November 2nd. So specifically, some of the requirements of the form include electing the form of bid assurance collateral that you'll provide, cash or a letter of credit. If applicable, you'll submit evidence that the IPA has determined the project labor agreements submitted for the project meet the requirements. That again is for projects that have started construction. And you'll provide an indicative quantity for the project. The indicative quantity is an annual number of RECs that you plan to bid, but it is totally non-binding at the Part 2 stage. This slide provides the required bid assurance collateral amounts. Bid assurance collateral is a function of the size of the project. The amounts are on a per megawatt basis applicable to each company and provided here. The first column is applicable to wind and hydro. The second column is applicable to solar and brownfield. We provide an example here for how to calculate bid assurance collateral for a wind project. So for example, the bid assurance collateral required for a wind project that's 200 megawatts would be 320,000 sent to Ameren, 800,000 for ComEd, and 80,000 submitted to MidAmerican. If a bidder presents proposals for multiple projects, you can use a single letter of credit and you can affect a single wire transfer in the amount that's required for all of your projects. Additional requirements related to bid assurance collateral are provided here on this slide. If you're submitting cash, you'll provide a W-9 to the entity to which the cash should be returned, and you'll provide draft requests for return of cash. We have samples of such a request that would be approved by the companies. So you can download those and fill them out and submit them with your Part 2 for our review. You'll also be required to acknowledge the conditions under which cash can be drawn. If you're submitting the pre-bid letter of credit for your company, then the bank will use, again, either the electronic version or the hard copy version. You must use the formats, either appendices 5 to 7 or 8 to 10, or you can incorporate approved modifications from the lists that are posted to the website. If you're using the hard copy version, it's highly recommended that the bank also submit a PDF and a tracking number so that the companies can track the package. We're going to send, again, to qualified bidders very detailed instructions for submitting this collateral. And lastly, a note here again that if you use cash as bid assurance collateral, then you can use that cash towards performance assurance if you do have a winning bid. So that includes the qualification process. I have a final section here with protocols for bid submission and steps for the post-bid process. So a customized bid form that we're going to provide to each bidder is the only way to submit your bids. Bid forms are submitted to a secure bid transfer site on the bid date on December 2nd during a two-hour bid window, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. noon central. If the bid form is not completely filled out or if it's inconsistent with the rules, then it won't be evaluated on the bid date. But once the bid window closes, there is a cure deficiency period of an hour. So if you submit a bid form and it has an issue, we'll get in touch with you during that cure window. So please be available, and then you can remedy the issue and resubmit by the deadline. We will provide a step-by-step guide to bidders with qualified projects, and you'll have an opportunity to practice in a training session. And notably, there is a backup method by email for bid submission should you experience technical issues with the online bid transfer site on the bid date. So your bid is going to consist of three core elements. You're going to provide a strike price for the project in dollar per megawatt hour. You'll provide a full quantity, and that represents the annual quantity of RECs the seller is offering to deliver. And then you also provide a minimum quantity, and that represents the minimum annual quantity of RECs that the seller is willing to accept as a partial award. Again, a project may receive a partial award, so an amount less than the full quantity, but never below the minimum quantity, if that project is the marginal project selected during evaluation. And again, the marginal project is just the project that, if selected, would mean exceeding the target for a category. So in this table here on the slide, in the dark purple cells, we have a hypothetical 100 megawatt wind project. They're submitting to deliver an annual quantity of 300,000 RECs. The bidder inputted a minimum quantity that's less than the full quantity. So here the bidder is indicating that it would accept a partial award of no less than 250,000 RECs at the strike price of $100. So this means if it's not possible for us to select at least 250,000 RECs, then the project would not be selected. Very importantly, in the bid form, the bidder is also asked to select the index hub, either MISO Illinois hub or PJM NIHUB, that will correspond to the bid for this project. This hub, of course, is used for purposes of payment under the contract for the project. On the bid date, we expect to notify bidders by 6 p.m. Central Time whether their projects have a bid that's going to be identified as a winning bid to the ICC. At that time, if the bidder has not already provided the information to prepare the rec contracts with the proposal, then you'll be required to send that information to us by email so we can populate contracts. Within 2 business days of the bid date, the procurement administrator and the procurement manager each submit a confidential report to the ICC. And then within 2 business days of receipt of the reports, the ICC decides whether to accept or reject the results. Once the commission renders its decision, each company will send partially executed contract documents to the seller. The seller then countersigns and sends back the contract documents electronically and fulfills creditworthiness requirements. We will be sending instructions regarding contract execution procedures to bidders with qualified projects. The collateral requirement under the index rec contract is due within 8 business days of approval of the results by the commission, and payment of supplier fees to the Illinois Power Agency is due within 7 business days of approval of the results by the commission. And again, a note here that bid assurance collateral can be drawn upon if supplier fees are not paid within 7 days of approval. So that completes the presentation portion of the presentation. If you have questions, please do submit them to the panelists. You'll click on the chat icon at the bottom of your screen. The chat panel will appear, and then you can type in your question and hit enter. We'll pause now and wait for questions to come in. Thank you.